President Obama has decided people can keep insurance plans that might have been canceled, if they want, for a year. This hour, what that means for us in Iowa. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, experts reshape the treatment guide for cholesterol. The story of an Iowa school teacher forced to resign after being videotaped having sex with a colleague in a classroom closet. Thoughts on suggested changes to federal prison sentencing guidelines. IPR's Clay Masters tells us about the tensions surrounding a new airport in Mahaska County. And Dean Borg reflects on the closing of a popular central Iowa restaurant. Get ready for your Friday News Buzz after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A Friday News Buzz edition of our program. It's a chance for us to have quick conversations about a number of items in the news that we didn't get to earlier this week. And coming up later in the program, we'll have some thoughts on suggested changes to federal prison sentencing guidelines. Also, an Iowa school teacher, the story of an Iowa school teacher forced to resign after being videotaped having sex with a colleague in a classroom closet. IPR's Clay Masters will be along to tell us about tensions surrounding a new airport in Mahaska County. And at the end of the hour, Dean Borg reflects on the closing of a popular central Iowa restaurant. But first, yesterday we heard that President Obama relented to pressure from the public and also from his own party and changed one of the bedrock requirements of the new health care law. He's fulfilling his promise to allow people to help to keep their insurance plans if they want for a year. Here's some of what the president had to say yesterday.
With respect to the pledge I made that if you like your plan, you can keep it. I think, you know, and I've said in interviews that there is no doubt that the way I put that forward unequivocally ended up not being accurate. It was not because of my intention not to deliver on that commitment and that promise. We put a grandfather clause into the law, but it was insufficient.
So the president said insurance companies could continue for another year to offer health plans sold to individuals and small businesses that do not meet requirements under the new law that set minimum standards for benefits that policies must cover. A move aimed at solving a problem that has threatened the president's credibility and the public's faith in the law, but also raised a slew of new questions. Joining us now to talk not about the political side of this story, but about the implications for those seeking new health insurance or those wondering whether they can stay on their current plan. Joining us in our studio again, Dan Shane, assistant professor in the Department of Health Management and Policy at the University of Iowa. Dan, welcome back.
And glad to be back, Ben.
So tell us, what does this mean for those listening who have received notice their health insurance provider from their health insurance provider that their policy would no longer be available?
Well, it's possibly the news they want to hear. It's something that we're going to be learning as we go. It gives insurance companies actually the ability that they already had for insurance plans that expired anywhere up to December 31st, 2013. So any plan now that expires at any point in 2014, so a plan that would have been purchased on the individual non-group market, the insurance company would have the ability to then extend that plan for another year. So whether they actually take up the administration's offer and go back and reissue those plans is something that we just don't know at this point.
So do we know how many Iowans this may affect?
I heard the insurance commissioner in the state of Iowa this morning saying that in Iowa it was likely only to affect a relatively small number of people, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 that might be subject to cancellation policies upcoming. So in Iowa it may be a relatively small issue. Nationwide, it could be a much larger issue.
Mm-hmm. So this is not forever. This is an extension for 1 year. So you can put off the work or whatever change you need to make if you fall into that category for a year.
Right. So the insurance companies have had to get on board with new policies. Anything issued on January 1st, 2014 or after has to abide by the ACA regulation. So it has to have a much more comprehensive set of coverages. So maternity benefits, mental health benefits, and a host of others. This sets that back only, again, for individuals that are already covered under a non-group policy. It gives the insurance companies the option to extend those for another year.
Do we know that of those who were given notice of a policy cancellation, that is true for all of those, that they just didn't measure up to the new ACA standards?
That's correct. On some measure, whether it's out-of-pocket cost, whether it's coverage options, something didn't measure up. And the administration actually, as part of this new rule, has required insurance companies in what would be a letter possibly offering individuals the option to renew this plan. They're going to have to point out where these plans fall short of the ACA regulations going forward.
The insurance company. So it's really the burden is on the insurance companies now.
That's exactly right.
Okay, good. So what does this mean for those listening who did get notice about that? Should they do something, contact their insurance, sit tight for a while? What happens?
I suspect the best advice is to sit tight and see how this plays out. The insurance companies, if they choose to reconstitute these plans and rescind cancellations or looking forward offer to renew plans in 2014, they're going to contact their existing clients and let them know what their options are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So this affects individual policies. I think it's been a problematic part of the insurance market for many years because unlike if you have it through your employer, a group policy, what? You're tending to have much higher premiums?
That's correct. Really, the non-group market is a price discrimination game. So if you win that game, you may have reasonable low premiums. If you're a young male, for example, and you are posing relatively low risks in terms of your healthcare cost, it's possible that you are getting a fairly good deal on the non-group market. The reason it's a good deal is because these plans exclude as much as possible those who have higher healthcare costs. The ACA does away with that. Price discrimination based on gender, based on pre-existing conditions is gone. This is a feature of the ACA, but some of the individuals who are getting covered through this non-group market are facing higher costs. And
right.
And that's certainly going to be painful for those who are paying those costs. This gives a potential for some of these individuals to put off that cost for another year.
And as you mentioned, you know, one of the problems with individual policies is people when they got sick would tend to be cut off from their insurance. And the insurance companies did not do this just to be mean. They did it for business reasons, right?
Certainly.
Get rid of the liabilities, get rid of the people costing you the most money.
Right. That the insurance, they refer to it as the medical loss ratio. So the more they pay out in terms of costs versus the premiums they take in, the worse they do financially.
So here I am now. Let's say I'm back in my 20s, a young, healthy 20-year-old, and I had a really cheap policy, a no-frills policy, and I got notice that it would be canceled. And then I hear the president yesterday say, no, you can hold on to it. I think if I'm 20 and healthy, I might just hang on for a year. Is that what's thought will happen?
It's certainly – if the impact of this happens, I mean, depending on how large it is, the most likely participants who would take up the insurer's offer to keep this plan for another year would be the healthier individuals. So
to the detriment of the entire system or not?
Of the exchanges, right. So the idea was that these policies would be canceled. These individuals would then be on the exchange. So it would improve the overall health of participants in the exchange. Now, to the extent that this actually causes individuals to keep those plans, then the plans in the exchange, individuals in the exchange, would be slightly less healthy overall.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to point out there are a number of checks in this system, however. So the ACA expected the early phases of the rollout to be problematic. They expected that insurance companies may not get premiums exactly right, compared to the individuals that actually signed up for those plans. So through 2016, there are actually some buffers for insurance companies that limit the downside of losses if they have relatively unhealthier participants in their plans.
This move was made by the president, I understand, without consulting health insurance providers. And as a term used in the Morning Edition report, we heard about it from NPR, a wrench thrown in the works might be a way to describe it when you look at the perspective of insurance providers. They've canceled millions of policies across the country. Not as easy as flipping a light switch back on.
not at all. So the insurance companies would have to reconstitute these plans. They're going to have to go through a number of administrative steps, not the least of which is proving to their state insurance commissions that the premiums that they expect to collect as part of these plans are enough to cover the expected costs. So there are a number of steps that you would have to do to file this what would become a new plan, and it's not clear how many insurance companies would take up the administration on this offer.
Okay, Dan Shane, assistant professor in the Department of Health Management and Policy at the University of Iowa. Chapters to come, and we will follow the chapters in the future with you, Dan Shane. Thank you for filling us in on this latest development.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a News Buzz edition on this Friday. The American College of Cardiology and American Heart Association have released new guidelines regarding the treatment of high cholesterol in the prevention of heart attack and stroke. Cholesterol expert Dr. Jennifer Robinson joins us now to talk a little bit about the new guidelines. Dr. Robinson, welcome.
Thank you, Ben.
You are a professor of medicine and epidemiology in the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa. Also significantly here, you served as vice chair for the 2013 U.S. Cholesterol Guidelines Panel. So we have these new guidelines, taking a new approach to how doctors approach treatment for patients with certain types of cholesterol. Explain what difference this makes, the different approach.
Well, the thing we did a little bit differently than in the past was to we spent about 4 years actually looking at all of the clinical trials that had been done over decades that for treating cholesterol to prevent heart attacks and strokes. So our focus was really on preventing heart attacks and strokes. And what we found was that there were four groups that really benefited. There were people who already had a heart attack or stroke. They were people with genetically high cholesterol, people with diabetes, and then other people who had other risk factors that put them at high risk during their next 10 years or their lifetime for heart attacks and strokes. So we really focused on preventing heart attacks and strokes, and we kind of stepped back from those LDL goals. You know, people, your doctor tell you maybe about your bad cholesterol being less than 100 and things.
If we have for your annual checkup, you get different cholesterol readings. What is it, three? There's four numbers.
There are four numbers.
Yeah. Well, what are they?
Right, there's the total cholesterol, and the HDL is the good cholesterol. Triglycerides are the fat. And then LDL is the bad cholesterol. And that was the focus before, and that should be less than 100, for example. And when we looked at those clinical trials, there was no evidence, we call it, that treating to a number made any difference. What really made a difference is, were you at risk for a heart attack or stroke? And that's why we focused on those four groups that I just mentioned.
So by focusing on those four groups, we're really narrowing it down and making the blanket much smaller.
Well, right. It turns out about 35 million Americans are already on a statin. Only half the people with heart disease are on a statin.
Remind us what a statin is?
A statin is it's a drug like Lipitor. It's, Zocor, they're all generic now, of course, but it's the drugs that are very effective for lowering cholesterol, anywhere between, 30 to 50%. So they really do drop those numbers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so does that mean when I go in for my annual physical, those four figures, if I'm not in that group of at risk or risk factor people, those four things will not be considered by my doctor?
Well, we look at them too, but they're not, more to see, if you're, for example, if your LDL, your bad cholesterol is over 190, you automatically get a statin after age 20, pretty much, unless there's, a really good reason not to give you one. So we do use those numbers in some sense. And we also look at to see how effective the statin is on lowering your cholesterol. You might need a higher dose, for example. But it's really a focus. So what we found was that people were not being treated properly. You could have an LDL less than 100, on just a little tiny dose of a statin and have heart disease. And that's not adequate. That's not the right answer. We'd also find that people were using multiple drugs, not just statins, to get LDLs very low. And there's no evidence now from clinical trials that adding a second drug to a statin does anything. So the mm-hmm. focus turned out to be on statins. We didn't expect them to be statin guidelines, but that's what they turned out to be.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Robinson, now you just said people were not being treated properly.
Mm-hmm.
Is this somebody messing up?
Well,
why would we treat people in a certain way for years and then only now realize it's not the proper way?
Because we do more studies, and I would encourage people to sign up and participate in studies, because we learn in science by doing experiments, and experiments in people are called clinical trials, and we see if they prevent heart attacks and strokes. And so since the last set of guidelines 10 years ago, we've had a whole slew of new studies that really have shown – you know, what I just said, that statins are the thing to focus on, and that adding a second drug to a statin really doesn't seem to add a whole lot and may make things a little less safe for people.
Right. And I am saying that also because, you know, we hear sometimes in science and medicine, we hear for a long time that we should or shouldn't do something.
Mm-hmm.
And then a new study comes out and it turns out to be turned on its head in some way.
Right.
This is not the case here.
Well,
or is it?
Well, it's accumulated over time. So over the last 10 years since the last guidelines, we have learned a lot of new things. And we have subsequently now made new guidelines to reflect that information for people. So, you know, it's not a sea change. Most people were getting treated with statins. And we were already treating, you know, trying to focus on people at high risk. But now we just are trying to make it as clear and simple as possible so doctors know. And patients know, too, because you need to go to your doctor and say, well, you know, I'm in one of those four groups. I need a statin, doctor. And your doctor can say, you're right, you do. And you know, kind of have a conversation with people about what the best treatment would be for them for preventing heart attack and stroke.
So that is that the takeaway from these new guidelines for anyone listening? Succinctly tell me what that takeaway is. If you are what, then do what?
If you are in one of the four groups that benefit from a statin, you need to be on one to prevent heart attacks and strokes. Those four groups are people who've had a heart attack or stroke, people with diabetes, people with high genetic cholesterol, so the magic number is 190, or people with lots of risk factors like high blood pressure and smoking and things like that.
People outside of those groups need to do what differently? Anything?
Well, they need to still have a conversation with their doctor. We certainly think that lifestyle is the foundation for everything we do. It's just that when you live in America long enough, after about age 50, lifestyle has not been enough, and you might need a drug to reduce your risk of heart attack and stroke.
Okay, Dr. Jennifer Robinson, thank you very much, Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology in the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa. We appreciate it, and I know you have to get going,
thank you,
so
Ben.
Thank you for joining us. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, before we end this half-hour segment, on to a bit of news this week that we, I guess, have to put in the what the fill-in-the-blank were you thinking category of news. The story of an Iowa school teacher who has been forced to resign after being videotaped having sex with a colleague in a classroom closet. Yes, you heard right. Here to tell us more about this unusual story, Clark Kaufman, investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register, who wrote about this odd story this week. The reason being, after a judge ruled that the teacher who resigned was not entitled to unemployment benefits. Clark Kaufman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So tell us, how did this story start?
Well, it started more than a year ago when there were students at the school gossiping about the conduct of a particular teacher, a high school science teacher. And subsequently, the district investigated, placed cameras around the school, and confirmed that this conduct had taken place. But it didn't really become public until there was this hearing on the teacher's request for unemployment benefits. He was making the argument that because these sexual encounters had taken place during his off hours at the school, in other words, during the lunch hour and immediately after classes were dismissed, that it didn't actually constitute workplace misconduct. And that argument didn't carry the day. The judge ruled otherwise, but that was his argument at the hearing.
Mm-hmm. So if we back up a little bit, this is amazing. This story starts with gossip around the school in West Branch,
yeah.
Sorry, getting around the staff hearing about it, And the follow-up was, according to your article, that what the principal talking to the teacher, and the teacher said?
The teacher denied that there was any sort of inappropriate relationship with this colleague. The colleague was a paraprofessional who worked at the school, which usually means sort of an instructional aide, that type of thing. So the teacher, the science teacher, had denied that there was any sort of inappropriate conduct. And these rumors go back actually to the 2011-2012 school year. Mm-hmm. But then it was during the following school year, which was last calendar year, that the superintendent was confronted by a patient who said her child had come home and said that he'd been in the classroom and was hearing noises in the closet. And then afterward, these two individuals who were employed by the school emerged from the closet. So the student obviously was able to put two and two together, complained to his mother. The mother then complained to the superintendent, who then had a video camera installed in the closet at the school.
And then in testimony, we heard, too, the detail that a classroom window, I assume a window to in a door.
Correct.
To the classroom would be covered up during the noon hour.
Yeah, there were complaints from both students and faculty, apparently, that this particular teacher would cover up the window on the door to the classroom during the noon hour when people knew that the two individuals were in the classroom, and then later they would come out. And as the superintendent said during the hearing, when two people go into a closet and make noises and then come out, there's kind of an assumption of what is going on, is how she phrased it.
An incredible story. So the cameras were installed also in the closet. Footage there showed...
But apparently the footage is detailed, so because the camera was right inside the closet, and so as the superintendent testified, it shows the two individuals getting undressed, and as she said, it shows everything. And she did show the video to the teacher, gave him the option of resigning or being fired. He chose to resign, but she had confronted him with the evidence before he made that decision.
Chose to resign, but felt that he was still entitled to unemployment benefits, and that was the decision that judge made this week, saying, no, you aren't. What was his side of the story?
Well, he did acknowledge that these encounters took place. It was just he was arguing that because he didn't have any specific assignments in front of him during those hours, that he was essentially on his free time, just as one might be on their lunch hour or whatever. But, of course, the argument from the school district and the argument that the judge made was that just because you're on your own time, it doesn't give you the ability to do things like this on school property, particularly when you've been warned by your supervisors that you shouldn't be carrying on any sort of inappropriate relationship mm-hmm. in the school.
Clark Hoffman, any other charges expected in this case?
No, I don't think so. There is a question as to whether or not this was even reported to the Board of Educational Examiners. The superintendent will not say whether or not she reported it to the board, but currently there are no charges, licensing charges that have been imposed against the teacher.
We have just a few seconds left, but I know, Clark, you cover a lot of different news at the Des Moines Register. Has to be one of the strangest stories you've covered?
Well, these unemployment stories are you come across some really strange reasons in terms of why people are separated from their employment. There's a lot of unusual cases, but this one definitely would be near the top. Yeah.
Clark Hoffman, thank you very much. Investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll have some thoughts on suggested changes to federal prison sentencing guidelines. Also, Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters tells us about tensions surrounding a new airport in Mahaska County. And Dean Borg reflects on the closing of a popular central Iowa restaurant. Maybe you've been there. It's on U.S. Highway 69, just north of Ames, the Suburban. We'll talk about that in the next half hour. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a News Buzz edition. We'll be back in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a News Buzz edition of our program, an hour for us to make quick conversational hits on recent news stories we haven't talked about otherwise. There have been a growing number of voices heard here on Iowa Public Radio and elsewhere in the media calling for a change in federal sentencing guidelines in an effort to reduce prison overcrowding. Matt DeLisi is a professor of sociology at Iowa State University. He says this would be a mistake. Earlier this month, DeLisi testified before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee on this issue. He also coordinates the Criminal Justice Studies program at Iowa State and is a member of the Center for the Study of Violence at that university. He was part of a panel invited by the committee at the before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee to comment on proposed policy changes detailed in a report from the Urban Institute. Matt DeLisi joins me now. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
First of all, can you tell us what changes in guidelines are discussed in this report by the Urban Institute?
Sure. The Urban Institute produced a report called Stemming the Tide, Strategies to Reduce the Growth and Cut the Cost of the Federal Prison System. There are currently about 219,000 prisoners in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and that population takes up about 25% to 35% of the entire Department of Justice budget. So there's a desire to reduce the number of prisoners to produce money for other functions. There's also a concern that having so many prisoners is, socially speaking, is not a positive. And so the report is documenting some of the cost savings that we could have with reducing various types of criminal offenders. One of the things that was very comforting about the hearing was that there was consensus that there should be some release of federal prisoners, particularly when we can identify those who truly pose the lowest risk.
And you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Where my report or my perspective was brought in was to identify some of the various criminological risk factors that prisoners possess that would potentially create more crime if widespread numbers were released from BOP custody.
Mm-hmm. Because you have your own research that it focuses on antisocial behavior, the likelihood that offenders with extensive criminal histories will commit another crime. So how does that inform your opinion and your input into this testimony?
Well, currently there's a policy at the federal level where judges have the discretion to not invoke mandatory minimum sentences on especially drug offenders for those who have little to no criminal history. So there's already in place a mechanism to use the right best judgment to not have the little fish, so to speak, be sent away to federal prison. What the Urban Institute report does, though, it argues to it greatly expand that decision-making to apply to a wider range of offenders. And some of the ones that they identify in the report are drug offenders with extensive criminal history, weapons offenders, armed career criminals, sex abuse offenders, child pornography offenders, and identity theft offenders. Those are the very types of people who we do not want to be released, in part because of the severity of their antisocial behavior. And so my testimony was really to provide some quantitative estimates of how many crimes potentially could result from releasing various numbers of criminal offenders from BOP.
So if they went along with these recommendations in this report by the Urban Institute, can you quantify or take an educated guess at what would be the result as far as crimes committed of the type that you just mentioned?
Yes. And in my testimony, I really relied on two studies, both of which were conducted by economists, and I'll comment on that in a moment. Criminologists, generally speaking, are not terribly favorable about prisons because there are many negative features of prisons, and they probably do not reduce criminal offending other than for incapacitation, in which they're fantastic at. As such, research on the deterrent effects of prison within criminology are probably a bit specious. On the other hand, there are a range of economists who conduct very sophisticated quantitative studies of the various costs and benefits of criminal justice policies. And so a sort of personal assessment is that these econometric studies, on one hand, are probably better statistically and quantitatively, have better research designs, and economists, frankly, have no axe to grind in terms of criminal justice compared to criminologists. The two studies that I relied on were conducted independently using various sources of data and various types of methods. One study, produced by Stephen Levitt, who is famous for the Freakonomics book, estimated that for every prisoner we have in custody, it saves about 15 serious Part 1 index crimes a year. Another study conducted by economists named Marvell and Moody estimated that it was about 17 Part 1 offenses per year. And so I'm comforted that these independent researchers produced essentially the same estimate. So in my testimony, what I did is took the Urban Institute's estimates of how many offenders should be released and how many dollars would be saved, and simply multiply that number of offenders released by these estimates of 15 crimes per year and 17 crimes per year. And so, for example, one guideline they suggested was to release 2,000 offenders. That would produce an average of 30,000 to 34,000 new index crimes a year. Index crimes include murder, rape, armed robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, theft, auto theft, and arson.
A few days ago on this program, I had the pleasure of talking with the former Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, Marcia Ternus. And her message, what she wanted to talk about was, we have swung far too much in terms of punishment in our justice system and need to swing more toward the rehabilitation to find a better balance, given that the rate of inmates incarcerated in the United States continues to be dramatically higher than in other countries. To what extent can you agree with that, or does that tie in with your testimony here?
I agree in the sense that prisoners are really reflecting a punishment or retributive sort of approach. However, very rarely are offenders sentenced to prison on their first criminal offense. If you look at their offending careers, which generally encompasses dozens of arrests and convictions, they're given multiple opportunities for various types of community corrections, be it probation, intensive supervised probation, etc. Also, many offenders, when sentenced to prison at the state level, invariably are released on parole. Parole contains many conditions that are really addressing some of their criminogenic risks, and oftentimes offenders nevertheless violate and are sent back to prison. So to look at an individual offender who is serving perhaps a lengthy prison sentence, from one perspective, yes, that does reflect punishment. But from another perspective, a more lifelong or life course perspective, that person has had multiple opportunities for redemption, so to speak, and for a variety of reasons has not capitalized on it.
Mm-hmm. This discussion finds its place in the context of a prison population in the United States that dropped in last year in 2012, the third consecutive year that it has. Criminal justice experts saying it's the biggest decline in the nation's recent history. Some are saying it's a sea change in America's approach to criminal punishment. Now, I know this is bigger than federal prisons, what you're concentrated on here, correct?
The report is just on federal, correct.
Mm-hmm. But still, we have over 1.5 million people incarcerated in this country, as I said, far higher, dramatically higher than in other countries. So are you saying this is simply something we in the U.S. have to live with, even though other countries have such lower rates of incarceration?
Well, if you compare the United States to peer westernized nations, they have very similar crime levels, with the exception of homicide and with the exception of gun homicides. And so just on that crime of armed robberies and homicides involving firearms, that distinguishes the United States from peer nations. And so because you have those large differences in offending for those specific crimes, you're also commensurately going to have very different prison populations. I don't have the numbers right ahead in front of me, but there are hundreds of thousands of offenders who are confined for murder and other gun assaults and armed robberies. In Iowa, for example, an armed robbery or a first-degree robbery has a 25-year prison sentence. First-degree murder has a true life sentence. So these are crimes for which you're going to serve lengthy periods of time in confinement, and these are crimes that we just don't have at the same levels in other G20 nations.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned mandatory minimums, and that has been a recent development in our justice system. Are you in some cases happy? Does your evidence, your research tell you that it's okay to give judges greater discretion without mandatory minimums being imposed?
There's sort of an interesting story to tell about sentencing. For many decades in the middle to latter parts of the 20th century, judges had extraordinary discretion and sentences were indeterminate. So you could have two offenders convicted for identical offense, say a second-degree burglary, and the sentence to both of them would be 0 to 5 years in prison. It was indeterminate. And the one offender, let's say, declined any kind of rehabilitation programming in prison, continued to engage in misconduct while in confinement, and generally did not do well. That prisoner might end up serving 5 years or their full sentence. The other person convicted for the same crime might have done the exact opposite and been very compliant, been very productive, and really truly and earnestly worked toward their rehabilitation. And perhaps that offender was released in 9 months. That's a good thing in the sense that it makes punishment idiosyncratic and matching it to the desire of the offender to get better and to rehabilitate themselves. The downside of it is that you had widely varying sentences for the same underlying conviction offense. And so the criminal justice system really moved to determinate sentencing using sentencing guidelines that were essentially based upon a grid of what was the person convicted of and the offense seriousness and what was the person's criminal history. And so it's sort of ironic to me that we hear a desire for judges to have greater discretion because that's what they had in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And the manifestations of that discretion produces very disparate outcomes for the same underlying conviction offense.
Matt DeLisi, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Matt DeLisi is a professor of sociology at Iowa State University, also coordinator of the Criminal Justice Studies program at ISU. And we're finishing up our NewsBuzz edition of River to River on this Friday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Plans to build a new regional airport are underway in south central Iowa's Mahaska County. There are two existing airports, one in Oskaloosa and Pella. They would close, and a new consolidated one would provide services to large companies in the area. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters joins us now. Perhaps you've heard his report on this. To talk a little bit more about the fight over whether or not a new regional airport will help the area's economy. Hi, Clay.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon. In your coverage of this new regional airport in Mahaska County, you met with a number of individuals, including a web developer named Rob Hammond. Now, he feels, let's listen to what he has to say. He feels that the future economic development in Mahaska community does necessitate a new airport.
And they continue to say, well, how can we sell our community to businesses when we don't have an airport that can support them? But that's not true. Both cities have airports, and they've had them for 40, 50 years. So how can suddenly a new airport with new shiny concrete be more attractive to a business than your existing airport?
Okay, so he is saying what exactly, Clay?
Well, it's an issue of, you know, they don't think that the airport needs to be there, but there are demands. The city of Pella has a problem with their existing airport. So these three larger companies in the area, Musco, Vermeer, and Pella, they want to fly a larger jet, a faster jet in so they can get customers and executives into the airport and to the businesses quicker. So, but they can't do it at the existing airport in Pella. Its runway can't handle these larger, more commonly used jets. And so the Federal Aviation Administration gave the green light for Pella to upgrade its airport. So there's been this agreement made between Oskaloosa, Pella, and Mahaska County where the agency can use eminent domain, and that's really sparked a lot of the backlash from many of these landowners and farmers like Rob Hammond, who we heard from, because now, you know, they can take a farm or land and develop there with eminent domain.
Mm. Now, eminent domain, we reminded, this is where a government body can take property, reimburse them for property, sell their land. They're forced to sell the land to the government.
Right, correct.
Uh-huh. Now, who benefits most from this new airport? It's
well
consolidated.
It will be primarily, like I mentioned, those larger companies that are flying in customers, executives. These will be people that are needing to do business in the area. Mm-hmm. So, and then there will also be, you know, private pilots that might have planes. They can use the hangars there. But it's central. So, you know, there's also consolidation to be had in, you know, more sparsely populated parts of the state.
Mm-hmm. There is a grassroots organization in Mahaska County, including some 70 farmers. Their take is different.
Right. And they think that they don't need an airport, that the two existing airports, as you heard in the cut, do the job. You know, there's a waiver that Pella has so they can still fly these larger jets in. But that waiver is in agreement that they will expand or build a new one.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a local story that you're covering for Iowa Public Radio, Clay Masters in Mahaska County, and plenty of counties in Iowa where our listeners are that they're not perhaps concerned about it. Tell us, why should we all be concerned about this?
Well, there's a lot of times where we're reporting on, you know, economic development ideas that this or that politician might have. And, you know, we talk about things so big picture. I was actually driving down 163 for a story this summer and saw all these signs and, like, Hammond's barn that was painted with a phrase on it. And I was just like, what is going on in this area? So for me, it might seem like a hyper-local piece, but it's also a way to, you know, hone in more on what kind of economic development opportunities are happening in the state. So we have kind of a context for the bigger picture.
Okay. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters, thank you for joining us. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And finishing up today, perhaps you've been to this restaurant. I haven't, and I guess I'll miss my chance because it's closing this weekend. A popular Central Iowa restaurant closing this weekend. Tomorrow night, it will close for good. And Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg joins us now. Hi, Dean.
Hello, Ben.
And many listeners heard your feature this morning on Morning Edition. They can listen to it again on iowapublicradio.org, our website. So this restaurant is the Suburban Restaurant. It's located where?
Well, it's just north of Ames, about 5 miles. It's about a mile outside the little town of Gilbert, right along Highway 69, right adjacent to a Casey's store. Mm-hmm. And it's not one, it's a destination. It's not one that you would happen along and say, oh, this looks like a good place to eat.
Mm-hmm. So it's been around how long?
50 years. You count back, and so that's back in 1973.
Mm-hmm. You recently visited the restaurant, sat down and had a meal. So what is the person coming in experience? What jumped out at you?
Well, it was Friday night. Iowa State University's homecoming was last weekend, and my extended family, we decided we can't get into cafes or restaurants in Ames. Let's go to the Suburban. I'd been there once, twice before, and it's outside town. Came in, and early in the evening, I mean late afternoon, standing room only. And we had a reservation, so we had to wait for a table. But mm-hmm. then we saw the placemats which said, Suburban Restaurant has breaking news. We are closing. It's been 50 years since we opened our doors, and thanks to you, it's been an amazing run. But now it's time for us to move on. Our last day will be Saturday, November 16th. We'll truly miss you all. Your support has meant so much. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts.
And this has really become such a tradition in that area for many people. What are the reasons for closing down after 5 decades?
Well, apparently the sisters who now operate it, Diane Cox and Nancy Bates. Nancy Bates is 67 years old, has developing some health difficulties, as others had told me. And that's the reason that they think that, as they say on the placemat, it's time to move on. But, Ben, this restaurant apparently has developed a clientele because it's, you know, so many restaurants say home-style dining, home cooking.
Yes. It's more that's the slogan, right?
More than a cliche here. they live it.
And what jumped out at me about your piece was you interviewed a woman, I think Anna was her name, that you and we're going to hear a little bit of what she had to say. Who is this woman?
Well, as I looked around, I went back the next day and went back and thought, They were closed early in the late afternoon, mid-afternoon. I went back. They were still closed. I went just before 4 o'clock, which was the opening time on the door, and they opened the door for me. And inside already were some diners. Others arrived. And seated over in a table in the corner near the door to the kitchen was a petite, meticulously groomed woman. I sat down beside her and asked her name.
My name is Anna Lamp. I live in Ames, Iowa, in the country. I don't want to talk about the closing. That's too sad. It's going to happen. It's not what the regulars want, but we understand why. Susie's health was not the best, and Diane can't do it all alone. I know we came when mother and father were here. We knew the mothers and father. We ate here with them when they were cooking. We saw these girls when they were younger and they were waiting on tables. Mm-hmm. It's been a long time. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the closest thing I have to family, these two girls.
Dean Borg, what a testimonial from Anna Lamp there. That really, in those few seconds, those words tell us what this restaurant has meant to some people in the area.
I'm glad you said that, Ben, because as a good reporter would do, I hope I'm good enough to be called a good reporter, I got a lot of interviews in the kitchen with the help, with other customers there. I decided only to use the interview along with the sisters of Anna Lamp because she epitomized what all we're feeling.
Okay, Dean, we're about ready to wrap this day up, but I guess if you can get to it, if you can find a seat before tomorrow night at the restaurant, you might want to take in a little bit of a tradition that is disappearing from the Iowa landscape. Dean Borg, thank you for telling us about the closing of the Suburban Restaurant. It's along U.S. Highway 69 north of Ames. Dean Borg, much, much more than a good reporter. All of us will vouch for that. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, thanks to John Pemble. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. And Monday on this program, instead of River to River, a special episode from the series Burn, an energy journal. Take a look at energy issues facing today's world. We'll look at rising sea levels as a result of climate change. That's Monday at this time. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.